I'm John Strum, and this is Real Talk MS. It's February 14th, and we have a lot to talk about. MS can occur at any age, with the overwhelming majority of people living with MS diagnosed between the ages of 20 and 50. However, between 3 and 5% of the people living with MS are diagnosed before their 16th birthday, and you've met some of those folks in previous episodes of this podcast. The National MS Society estimates that about 5,000 kids and teens are living with MS in the United States, and that number grows to 10,000 worldwide. In many respects, pediatric MS is just like MS in adults, but it carries with it a different set of what I'll call social complications that can feel even more challenging to navigate than the disease itself. Just think back to the awkwardness of your preteen and teenage years. School, friends, dating. It's a lot for any kid to deal with. And that's without having to think about a chronic illness like multiple sclerosis. Joining me in what I consider to be an absolute masterclass in pediatric MS is Dr. Brenda Banwell. Dr. Banwell is Chief of the Division of Neurology and Co-Director of the Neuroscience Center at the Children's Hospital of Philadelphia, and she's considered to be one of the foremost experts on pediatric MS in the world. But before we get to my conversation with Dr. Brenda Banwell, there are a few other things that you should know about. Researchers at the Tisch MS Research Center of New York have published the results of a study that perhaps sheds new light and some confirming evidence about primary progressive MS. Scientists have long held that primary progressive MS is driven by different mechanisms than relapsing remitting or secondary progressive MS. Well, the team at the Tisch MS Research Center has provided evidence to confirm this hypothesis, and that can lead to more precise research on primary progressive MS, and it suggests a new path in developing more targeted treatments for primary progressive MS. Now, in this study, scientists collected cerebrospinal fluid from 42 people who were living with MS. 17 of these people had primary progressive MS, 13 had relapsing remitting MS, and 12 had secondary progressive MS. Once they had collected the cerebrospinal fluid, it was injected into the space surrounding the spinal cord of mice. Now, the mice that were injected with the cerebrospinal fluid from the people with primary progressive MS started to exhibit motor symptoms, including reduced grip strength and limp tails. Further analysis showed that these mice had also experienced damage to their myelin, the fatty sheath that surrounds our nerve fibers in the central nervous system. This is the same sort of damage that's seen in multiple sclerosis. The mice that were injected with cerebrospinal fluid from people with relapsing remitting MS and secondary progressive MS, well, they didn't develop any motor symptoms, nor did they experience any myelin damage. This difference between the two groups of mice demonstrated that this capacity of cerebrospinal fluid to cause this myelin damage and create these motor symptoms was unique to primary progressive MS. Next, the research team wanted to determine the actual component in the cerebrospinal fluid that was collected from the people with primary progressive MS that was causing this condition, driving this MS-like disease in the mice. The team identified an antibody, a protein made by the immune system called immunoglobulin G. The next step was a process that filtered the cerebrospinal fluid from the people with primary progressive MS, removing this specific antibody. Then, that treated cerebrospinal fluid was injected into mice, and this time the mice did not develop any motor symptoms or experience myelin damage, which strongly suggests that this antibody in the cerebrospinal fluid, this immunoglobulin G, plays a critical role in inducing disability and producing myelin damage in primary progressive MS. The research team went on to create a lab-made version of immunoglobulin G, and when they injected it into the space around the spinal cords of mice, it created the same MS-like disease that the cerebrospinal fluid from people with primary progressive MS had created. And when they injected mice with the lab-made versions of the antibodies found in the cerebrospinal fluid of people with relapsing, remitting, and secondary progressive MS, none of the mice developed these MS-like symptoms. Armed with the evidence from their mouse study, the research team is planning to learn more about how these mechanisms differ between primary progressive MS and relapsing, remitting, or secondary progressive MS, and they plan on using this model to develop new treatments specifically for primary progressive MS. We're going to see this groundbreaking research carried out in other laboratories, and if the results of this study can be replicated, it's going to be a major step forward in understanding and ultimately treating those underlying mechanisms that are unique to primary progressive MS. Of course, I have to point out that this is an animal study, and it's never guaranteed that everything learned from an animal study will seamlessly translate when it's applied to humans. But there's no question that this study certainly represents a step forward in better understanding primary progressive MS. If you'd like to review the details of this study, you'll find a link in today's show notes. MS changes as we age, and people change as they age. Symptoms like balance, problems getting a good night's sleep, and fatigue are all common symptoms of MS. But they're also common symptoms of growing older. As we age, many people develop other health conditions that might include dementia, diabetes, cardiovascular disease, to name just a few. And these other health conditions, or comorbidities, also make treating MS more challenging. Treating older people with MS becomes even trickier because research on MS in older people is still very limited. And all of these challenges exist in a world where more people are growing older with MS than ever before. That's why the University of Texas at Austin Dell Medical School is launching a research and clinical initiative called Healthy Aging with MS. Healthy Aging with MS is led by Dr. Leora Freeman, and the goal is to create a multidisciplinary clinic and collaborative care model that focuses specifically on the needs of older people who are living with MS. The care team is going to include MS specialists, a physician's assistant, a nurse, a social worker, a clinical pharmacist, and a dietitian. And the team's goal is twofold: to provide care that meets the needs of older adults with MS, but also to answer the research questions that older adults with MS are most concerned about. So Dr. Freeman plans to study what drives MS progression and disability in older people, as well as the risk they face in taking multiple medications, medications specific to their MS, and medications they may also be taking to treat other health conditions. As people with MS continue to age, we can expect to see more research aimed at better understanding what treating MS in older adults should look like. And to that point, the results of a small study in Portugal suggest that people over the age of 60 who have stable disease can discontinue their disease-modifying therapy without any added risk of relapses or worsening disability. Scientists know that starting around age 60, our immune system weakens and becomes less able to mount an immune response. As people with MS age, they typically have fewer relapses. And if there is MS-related disability, at that point, it's usually not being driven by inflammation. And so the question is, are disease-modifying therapies still effective for someone over the age of 60? Well, one of the challenges in answering this question is that clinical trials for disease-modifying therapies typically exclude anyone over the age of 60. And as the MS population continues to age, perhaps we'll see that change. In the meantime, a research team in Portugal examined data from 35 patients treated at a single MS center. Now, these 35 patients were over the age of 60 and had not experienced a relapse or confirmed disease worsening from the age of 58. About two-thirds of the people with MS were women, and the mean age at the time of their diagnosis was just over 42 years old. 80% of the participants were being treated with glatiramer acetate or an interferon-based DMT. Only 3 of the participants were being treated with a high-efficacy disease-modifying therapy. 2 of them were on Gilenya, and 1 was on Tysabri. Over about 6.5 years, 13 of the study participants discontinued their disease-modifying therapy. Most of these 13 had secondary progressive MS. A few had relapsing remitting MS. The median age at the time of discontinuing their DMT was 63. At their final assessment in this study, there was no discernible difference in relapse rate or disability progression between those participants who had discontinued their DMT and those who hadn't. Those who had discontinued their disease-modifying therapy tended to have higher EDSS scores than those who continued their DMT, but the differences weren't considered very significant. The research team concluded that discontinuation of disease-modifying therapy did not influence the clinical outcome for these 35 study participants. As this was a small study, there's more work to be done here, and we can expect to see a greater research focus on the subject of aging with MS. In fact, a larger study in the U.S. looked at the question of whether to discontinue disease-modifying therapy among people living with MS who were over 55. And the outcome of this study was quite similar to the study results more recently reported from Portugal. And if you'd like to learn more about the study that was conducted in the U.S., you might want to listen to my conversation with the study's principal investigator, Dr. John Corboy, in episode 255 of Real Talk MS, and you'll find that link in today's show notes, along with the link to the study from Portugal. Switching gears from one end of the age spectrum to the other, we're going to transition our conversation from MS in older adults to focusing on MS in children and adolescents. We've just been talking about how treating MS changes as people age. As I mentioned at the top of this episode, treating MS in kids and teens brings its own set of unique challenges. And joining me to discuss pediatric MS is one of the foremost pediatric MS experts in the world. In a moment, we'll meet my guest, Dr. Brenda Banwell. Dr. Brenda Banwell is chief of the Division of Neurology and co-director of the Neuroscience Center at the Children's Hospital of Philadelphia. Dr. Banwell also holds the Grace R. Loeb Endowed Chair in Neurosciences, and she's a professor of neurology and pediatrics at the Perelman School of Medicine at the University of Pennsylvania. Welcome to the podcast, Dr. Banwell.
Thank you. Delighted to be here.
How prevalent is pediatric MS?
So approximately 3% of all individuals with multiple sclerosis will have their first MS attack prior to age 18. So in terms of the overall population of individuals living with MS, a small percentage start during childhood and teenage years. When looking at the prevalence in any country, it's about 1 in 100,000 children per year.
Since we're talking about such a small percentage, I'm wondering, do pediatricians know what to look for so that if a pediatric patient is showing signs or symptoms of MS, they can be referred to a neurologist?
So I think a pediatrician would recognize some of the core sentinel symptoms as requiring neurology care. I don't know that every pediatrician would necessarily know that those findings were multiple sclerosis per se. So, for example, common first attack symptoms in children can include optic neuritis, so visual loss, pain with eye movement. Some children will have numbness or tingling or weakness in the arms or legs. Some will also have spinal cord symptoms beyond that could include bladder difficulty. So those would obviously flag to a pediatrician that something neurological was happening. But I don't know that every pediatrician would immediately consider multiple sclerosis, given that many pediatricians will not have any multiple sclerosis patients in their practice.
If there is a history of MS in the family, are there things that a parent should be paying particular attention to in assessing their children? Are there things that they should be concerned about?
So the lifetime risk for multiple sclerosis in a family depends a little bit on how many people in the family have multiple sclerosis and their relationship to the child. So if it's a parent who lives with multiple sclerosis, their children's risk lifetime for multiple sclerosis is approximately 5% for boys and 5% for boys and 3% for girls. No, the other way around. 3% for boys, 5% for girls. Sorry. In that sense, there's obviously a greater than 95% likelihood that their children will not experience multiple sclerosis. There is interest in discussing vitamin D nutrition in families that live with multiple sclerosis and whether making sure that all family members maintain good vitamin D nutrition and whether that might conceptually reduce the likelihood of multiple sclerosis down the road. There is no evidence that that actually occurs at this point, but it is the other way around, which is that the vast majority of individuals diagnosed with multiple sclerosis have very low levels of circulating vitamin D, and low vitamin D is a risk factor for multiple sclerosis. It's important to note that the American Academy of Pediatrics recommends that all children take vitamin D supplementation. So it is actually a health recommendation for children in general, and I would encourage families to follow that recommendation. And make sure that their children have good vitamin D health.
When we talk about pediatric MS, are we talking about relapsing remitting MS, or is there also primary progressive pediatric MS?
So we are talking about relapsing remitting multiple sclerosis at onset. Every child that I have ever been referred, or who has ever been referred to me with the possibility of primary progressive multiple sclerosis, for example, has ended up having a very different diagnosis. So progressive neurological impairment from onset is very, very much likely, much more likely to be diagnosed with something other than multiple sclerosis in children.
As someone ages, does being diagnosed with pediatric MS have any effect on their disease progression?
So pediatric onset MS patients, using information from years ago prior to treatment, we know that entry into secondary progressive disease, where disability continues to worsen in the absence of relapses, in someone who previously had relapsing remitting MS, does occur, often about 20 years after the first attack in pediatric onset MS patients, at a time when they're at that point in their 30s or early 40s. Now, we're hoping, and some early, recent data coming out of Italy strongly suggests that that's changing, and that patients that have been treated from onset or very close to the beginning of their MS journey, that pediatric patients no longer have the same risk for developing disability years later. And of course, we all want to confirm that in the coming decades.
On previous episodes of the podcast, we've talked about the work being done to identify the prodromal phase of MS. When it comes to pediatric onset MS, where does that fit, or does it fit at all?
So it definitely fits. I think, you know, if you look at the MRI scan of a teenager presenting with their first MS attack, you can see not only multiple lesions, because pediatric multiple sclerosis patients have a high relapse risk as well as a high disease burden on MRI. So, for example, some of my patients have more than 100 lesions present on their first MRI. We also see areas of tissue injury called black holes, which indicate that the MS disease process has been going for some time. So I think the prodromal phase, at least defined biologically as a period of time before the first attack, is very clearly present in children. In terms of symptoms, if you go back, some of my patients will tell me that they've been struggling in school for the 6 months or a couple or a year or even longer prior to the first attack. Some will tell me they've been more tired, and some will tell me they've had a greater rate of depression. So I do think there's a prodromal phase in pediatric MS too.
Well, your last comment really brings me to my next question. I was going to ask you whether pediatric MS patients deal with cognitive issues and or fatigue, and if they do, how does that impact their academic life?
So I think cognitive impairment is, in fact, one of the most important aspects of pediatric onset MS and one of the aspects of this disease that requires closest attention. So at least a third of pediatric onset MS patients will struggle in high school and require both cognitive testing to figure out how they learn best and where they have challenges. And then even more importantly than just testing is how can we implement a program that optimizes what they can do well, how they learn best, so that they can optimize their high school experience. That's absolutely essential and a fundamental part of care. At least 30%, probably higher, of my teenage MS patients tell me that they've experienced symptoms consistent with depression and sometimes anxiety. And certainly active mental health care is pivotal in managing pediatric MS patients, not only the patients, but also their family. And there have been some recent studies showing that particularly mothers, but not leaving dads out, that parents of youth with MS, the parents have a higher rate of depression and a higher need for mental health support. And even more interestingly, I think in terms of thinking about prodrome and the sort of microenvironment we live in, many of these symptoms also started before their child's first MS attack. So it was not all reaction to living with a new diagnosis of MS in the family. Some of this may have been there before. And it just emphasizes that MS lives in a family and everybody needs appropriate care and support.
I'm going to circle back to that in just a moment. I wanted to ask you about disease-modifying therapies. They've been shown to limit relapses. They've been shown to delay progression. How effective have they been shown to be in children, and which DMTs have received FDA approval for treating pediatric MS?
So fingolimod, which is an oral tablet, is the only fully approved therapy for pediatric multiple sclerosis based on a clinical trial that compared fingolimod to interferon beta-1a by muscular injection weekly. In that study, the children receiving fingolimod had an over 80% reduction in frequency of relapses compared to children receiving the injectable therapy. Neither knew which was the real therapy at the time. Everyone was unaware of which treatment each child was receiving until the end of the study. But those that received the real oral fingolimod clearly had a reduction in relapse rate. There were far fewer MRI changes in the children on fingolimod. And so the drug was approved based on efficacy and, of course, on safety that was carefully monitored. There are other trials ongoing that have not yet completed or haven't resulted in FDA approval. So many of the treatments we give as pediatric neuroimmune specialists are given outside of FDA approval, but with specific advocacy in terms of access.
You know, whether it's pediatric onset or adult onset MS, I often say that MS doesn't only affect individuals, it affects families. As you pointed out a moment ago, that's most clearly the case when a child is diagnosed. And, you know, while all parents are caregivers, the parents of a child living with MS have to maintain their parental roles while adding, sometimes considerably adding, to their roles as caregivers. What's the best strategy for those parents who want to take care of, support, protect, and not smother a child who's living with MS while maintaining their own emotional equilibrium? What's their best approach to living with MS?
Lots of things to say here. I think the first and foremost is information, accurate information. And I think it's really important that parents have that accurate information. And it's really important that teenagers and children have accurate information at an age appropriate level if they're on the younger end. Truth matters to families, telling them that this is a serious diagnosis, but it's not fatal, that there are good treatments, but you have to take them if they're going to work. That we need to support the whole person, and that includes wellness, activity, mental health, that we need to have a forum for families to talk so that they get the support they need. It's why it's a multidisciplinary care model. This is a team approach to help a family through the true crisis of having a serious diagnosis in any of their children. We're not built as parents to have our children have healthcare challenges. And so first and foremost is information. Second, I think is autonomy for the child. This is, you know, particularly teenagers. enabling teenagers to understand their healthcare, to make choices, to have them actively choose the therapy that they feel they're best going to adhere to is absolutely essential. As any parent knows, if you tell a teenager to do something, it's a very different outcome than if the teenager is engaged and then replies to you that he or she is excited to take this therapy or feels it's the right thing for their health. The approach really matters. And I think it makes a huge difference in long-term adherence. And then I think the third thing is finding the right supports. And by right, I don't mean to be prescriptive. I mean, in terms of providing, support through the MS societies regionally and nationally, where parents can be availed of really professional advice in coping with this new information in their family. Having a conversation between parents and their teenagers or children about whose news this is and who they're going to share it to. Teenagers in general share with me that they don't like that everybody gets to hear about their new MS diagnosis without their permission. Parents share with me that their first instinct is to ask absolutely anyone who might have valuable information for them in their mind to how it would help their child. They'll talk to their neighbor. They'll talk to someone they heard lives with MS. They'll talk to the teachers. They'll talk to the grandparents. They'll call their best friend. They'll reach out to colleagues at work. All natural instincts for a parent craving information to make this better, but not necessarily what their teenager wants them to be sharing. So it's I actually make my families have this early conversation in the car right after we've had the diagnosis to say, please talk about who can hear this information and when the teenager in particular is ready for that news to be distributed to others so that it doesn't come at them as now this new reality that defines them. Because it doesn't define them. It is part of who they are, but they are still who they are before. And I think all of that is a really big part of counseling families through this very difficult early stage. I will tell you that with highly effective MS therapies in children and teenagers that may be receiving, for example, infusion-based therapies 2 or 4 days per year in certain therapies, I ask them now what they think about living with MS. And most of my teenagers look at me confused and say, well, I don't think about it every day at all. I actually hardly think about it most days. I feel fine. I'm going to school. I'm in the band. I do track. I do whatever I do. I don't think about living with MS. When I started studying MS 20 years ago, the answer was, today's a needle day. Tomorrow, I'm going to feel like I have the flu. Tuesday, I might have to go and get blood work. Next week, I'm going to not be able to go on my school trip because I'm too tired to go. Or I can't go on overnight camp for 2 weeks because nobody will give me my injections. I don't hear any of that anymore. And I think that if you're, looking at the impact of living with MS on a family, it's so influenced by whether the child tells you that they feel like they live with MS every day or whether they look at their parents and say, I'm okay. I'm doing really well.
Getting the best healthcare often starts with finding the right healthcare provider. How can someone find a pediatric neurologic specialist and what should they do if there isn't one in their area?
So a terrifically important question. So I think first talk to the provider they have, whether that's a pediatrician, sometimes an adult MS expert, or an adult neurologist or the emergency room provider, depending where you are. There are lists of pediatric MS experts provided by regional and national MS societies so that people can find someone closer to them. Obviously, many of us write and advocate through resources like this to provide information for families so they can find experts to reach out to. If there's no one regionally, and there are many regions around the world that do not have a pediatric MS expert, then reaching out to connect either through your physician or directly. And if possible, many families will come to see an expert at least once if they're able to travel for a comprehensive assessment. And then we can provide shared care with the team locally. I would love that we could get to a point soon for national and international telehealth. I think telehealth brings great promise for the future. There's still barriers that I would love to see removed so that we could provide direct telehealth, which would not be as good as seeing someone in person, but way better than not at all, and could still be incredibly helpful for families. And then, of course, linking with regional MS centers that may, if not provide pediatric expertise, would reach out on their behalf to connect with a pediatric expert to get some specific context for a younger patient.
I tend to think of research as the engine that drives and delivers the future. What can you tell us about research that's currently focused on pediatric MS?
So currently, I think there's several avenues of exciting research that is moving forward. And in no particular order, one aspect of understanding multiple sclerosis in children and teenagers is to understand the impact. And here I'm speaking about looking at cognitive studies so that we can learn which areas of the brain are vulnerable to multiple sclerosis. And importantly, can we do things like cognitive rehabilitation to improve cognitive functioning? There's research that is looking at the structural impact of multiple sclerosis on the developing brain in particular, so that we can better understand not only what happens when MS occurs, but the treatments we give, can that dampen that injury? Can we see that our treated MS patients have fewer lesions, which they definitely do, that they're less vulnerable to any MS-related permanent injury, which they see less of when they're treated? And do they connect, if you will, the way they should as teenagers? Remember, our brain is a connectome. It's a network that matures with us as we go through life. And if something disrupts those connections, and multiple sclerosis does exactly that, it acts, the lesions act on the myelinated highways that we use to connect one region of the brain to another. What is the effect of that on how a child is processing information and functioning? Importantly, we're also all studying the immune system in youth and children with multiple sclerosis to understand what goes wrong. Why does the immune system recognize the brain as not belonging to you and thereby attacking? And can we learn how to turn that off in particularly effective ways? Therapies are doing that, but there may be other strategies. And then, as I mentioned several times in this conversation, we look at the clinical lived experience of our MS patients and their families. What is the effect on quality of life, mental health, suicidality, hopefully not an occurrence, but something we need to actually directly ask about. And then very importantly, as we manage and help a family, do we improve all of that?
You know, conducting clinical research can be challenging and perhaps more challenging when you're conducting it with children and teens. Can you talk about why it's so important for families to participate in pediatric MS research, and then perhaps how a parent or caregiver can find out more about that?
So I think fundamental to providing the best care that we can provide is to know whether the care we're providing is the best. We can't do that if we don't actually take careful clinical histories and information, if we don't look beyond a photograph of the brain. We need to actually quantify and measure impact in the brain. Taking a blood test or doing a spinal fluid analysis to confirm the diagnosis of multiple sclerosis, pivotally important, but we can do more. We can look at whether the immune cells that are present in that fluid, what are they doing? What are they reacting to? How are they behaving? And does that inform on which treatment might be better for that child and whether or not that child might have a greater or lesser likelihood of a high relapse rate or needing specific types of treatment. So families participating in that discovery is how we move the field forward, is how we take better care of their child, is how we take better care of children across the world. In clinical trials, where we're comparing drug A to drug B largely, that's the essential step to not only making sure that we evaluate how well a medication works for children with MS and making sure it's a good treatment for pediatric MS, but it's the next step to getting that therapy approved. And without approval in some countries, it can be incredibly difficult to gain health equity and access to care for children and teens living with MS. So we can't do what we do without it being a partnership with the families, and we're doing it together. My entire career has been about being engaged with families in understanding what's happening and how we can best help them.
Earlier, you mentioned that accessing good information is step one following an MS diagnosis. Are there specific resources you might recommend to families who are affected by pediatric MS?
Absolutely. So I think some of the best information worldwide lives in the online resources provided by regional and national MS societies, certainly in the United States and Canada, but around the world. Also by the MS International Federation, which is sort of an overarching organization. And in full disclosure, I'm the medical and scientific board director for MSIF. But these resources are designed to be available in multiple languages for people living in multiple parts of the world. So I think information that has been curated by organizations whose staff have dedicated their entire professional lives to helping individuals living with MS is information that I can confidently entrust to my families. There is a lot on the internet that is not curated. There's a lot of information that families seek that can take them in directions that I worry about. Sometimes information that is just completely the wrong disease, or more importantly, does not apply to pediatric patients at all. And so I encourage every family who, with the best of intentions, are Googling everything they can, or whose family members, neighbors, cousins, relatives, send them suggestions for treatment or options, to please share those suggestions with your provider and have a dialogue about choices.
Well, Dr. Brenda Banwell, thank you for all you do to improve the lives of families living with pediatric onset MS. And thanks for talking with me today.
Oh, absolutely, my pleasure. Nice chatting with you. And I thank the audience for listening.
While we're talking about pediatric MS, I want to share some pediatric MS resources that I think you'll find useful. First, to learn more about pediatric MS, along with virtual support groups for kids and teens living with MS and their parents, you might want to visit the National MS Society's website at nationalmssociety.org/pediatricms. To learn about an outstanding in-person camp experience for kids with MS and their families, you should visit Oscar the MS Monkey at mroscarmonkey.org. To learn more about pediatric MS research, visit the Network of Pediatric Multiple Sclerosis Centers at usnpmsc.org. And if you'd like to contribute to pediatric MS research by participating, be sure to visit iConquer MS for Kids and Teens, and you can find them at kidsandteens.iconquermsorg/kidsandteens. And you'll find all of those links in today's show notes. That's going to wrap up this episode of Real Talk MS. Real Talk MS is powered by the National MS Society. And you can share this episode of the podcast by letting your friends or family members know that all they have to do is point their web browser at realtalkms.com/285. You'll find that link in today's show notes, so you can easily copy and paste it right into your email or text. And if you have a minute, I hope you'll visit the Apple App Store or the Google Play Store and download the free Real Talk MS app for your iOS or Android smartphone or tablet. It's the best way for us to stay connected. The app will automatically download the latest episode of Real Talk MS. You'll be able to access any of our past episodes. You'll be able to save your favorite episodes. And it's a great way for me to share bonus content with you. The app is free, so I hope you'll download it today. I'm John Strum. Thanks for listening. Stay safe and make healthy choices.